Hello, and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host, Matt Kuhlman, and my guest this episode is Nikki Romanello. Nikki earned her BFA in sculpture from the Maryland Institute College of Art in 2008, and her MFA in sculpture from the Pratt Institute in 2011. In addition to sculpture, Nikki has a strong interest in paleontology and science that informs most of her projects. Working with bones or entire skeletons of animals, she contextualizes these forms in different ways, often casting the forms in uncommon materials such as soap. Join me as she describes these pieces along with her use of animals and other microorganisms in creating her work. Hi, Nikki. Thanks for being here with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. And so I was looking through your work online and going through your bio and stuff, and it seemed like where you came from and where you decided to move played a significant part in like your work in general. So do you want to explain like your background and that process of moving to the East Coast from Texas, right?
Definitely, mm-hmm. Yeah. I was born in Dallas and raised there up until I was about 20. And in Texas, there's not really like an apparent natural ecosystem. I mean, there is, but there's mostly grasslands, and it's kind of absent.
Is it very desert like there? I've only been through it once. Yeah, I remember it.
It's a lot of like high and dry grass.
Okay.
And there's some wildlife out there, but I mostly grew up in the suburbs, so it's mostly houses and cars and people and streets. And mm-hmm. And I was kind of a kid who was more interested in nature, so there were a couple places I could go to kind of explore. And I kind of got a little bit into art, I would say, in high school. I got into it, and there were a few colleges that would come and speak to us, and the one I really liked was MICA.
Okay.
And so that was kind of sparked my interest and what kind of pulled me up to the Northeast. Also, my family is from New Jersey and New York,
okay.
So I was always here visiting and going to the beach and, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of woods and stuff. So it was definitely an attractive place to come and study.
Mm. So when you were in Texas, did you still find a way to kind of find these like bones and animal parts that you're interested in?
Yeah, definitely. I actually, there was a creek I wasn't allowed to go play at as a little kid, and I ended up going there. I would sneak away and like go down to the creek, and I mostly like kick my shoes off and walk along the creek in the water. We also had a lot of snakes down there, which I didn't see very much, luckily, but sometimes I would dig in the dirt and I would find like what looked like, you know, the top of a skull, and I would dig and I would find like a whole skeleton.
Oh, wow.
And I would bring stuff home. My mother's like, why are you always bringing dead stuff home? So, but I always thought it was really beautiful to find those remains.
Mm-hmm. And so when you first went to Maryland, what kind of work did you start making off the bat there?
Actually, when I started at MICA, I was doing mostly painting and drawing, and it was mostly figure painting, figure drawing, and I didn't have any background, really, in sculpture yet, so I was doing a lot of life drawing. So we would have models come in, and I would start with that, and then part of my requirements was to take a sculpture class, and then the sculpture class, I realized that there was a vast, you know, display of materials that I had access to, and that I could bring painting and drawing into sculpture. And so that's kind of where I made my transition, and I found a lot more freedom in sculpture.
Okay. And what kind of forms were you working with at the time? Were you already starting on this kind of vein of work that you're on?
It was kind of funny because I started right away, I think, in those kind of sort of a natural feel to the work. We actually saw a video in class. We saw Andy Goldsworthy's work.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, I didn't know that that was a possibility. So then I made these little tiles, just like wall tiles, of like little rivers and things, and it was something that just looked very basic, kind of a transition between painting and sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
So it was almost like I was making paintings a little more 3D. Then I started to pull into ceramics a little bit, and then I started making more useful, functional things. And then I got into metal sculpture, and metal sculpture was amazing. That's where I really took off. And at the time, I was looking more at shell forms, because I had always collect shells even since I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started pulling in calcium-based remains into my work, which I found fascinating. So I pulled in, you know, a few shells to take a look at them, and then I started realizing that I could combine the metal sculpture with the shells and use this sort of like skin-like, you know, material, this really thin sheet metal,
mm-hmm.
And then morph it into these like cave-like forms. And then I started in my senior year, I was on this studying predator and prey relationships. And so I was trying to make something that would kind of put us back on the food chain. So I started actually getting to like the science of nature, not so much the actual physical beauty of nature. I pulled away from that and I started getting to like what's like the meat and math of nature. And that's kind of started my senior year at MICA.
What kind of areas of that research captured your interest most, or what did you take away from it?
Definitely started with biology.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it fascinating how different animals lived in symbiosis together and depended on one another.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time I got into my grad school at Pratt, I was studying everything from astronomy, chemistry, physics, mostly physics, and then, you know, trying to like combine that with biology. And then after grad school, I started getting into astrobiology and like trying to like combine different sciences together.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's how I was taught when I was in high school, they always combine different sciences together, and I found that really useful.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's just mostly, you know, reading different, you know, just very basic science books, and like still very fresh, still getting into it.
What are some animals that live symbiotically? I know that all humans have like mites that live in their hair and their eyebrows stuff, but
I mean, there's a whole ecosystem just within us.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of different funguses and bacteria, and they all kind of live together. It depends on what you eat, because what you eat can bring in a new type of bacteria.
Okay.
And so there's, if you ever change your diet, you notice there's like a couple days where, you know, you don't feel right. That's because the whole ecosystem in your body is changing over.
Interesting.
So, and also the scientists can't replicate the environment of the gut, so it's really hard. They're really hard to study.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually have to study them in a person. But there's things like, for example, like the hookworm, which is a parasite. When a person, I guess, it would ingest the hookworm,
mm-hmm.
It gets rid of allergies.
Yeah, so I've heard that story where somebody intentionally gave themselves hookworms because they had really bad allergies.
Exactly, it was on Radiolab.
Yeah.
So that's one example that sometimes when you gain a parasite, you can lose, you know, an affliction of some sort. So, and that's just with us. There are other animals, you know, of course, like the food chain, or there's like, you know, a fungus that eats out the inside of a tree, and then a bird only nests in that type of tree when it's hollow. So
mm-hmm.
it's, you know, things like that.
And you said something about placing humans back in the food chain a little bit. How did you do that with what your output was?
Well, I made this giant whale spiral shell crazy squid thing when I was it's actually up there on top of my bookshelf. You can kind of see
it. Oh yeah, there it is.
So they kind of look like these black bumpy razor clams, and they're about 5 or 6 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
They stand up, they kind of look like shields, you know, something
kind of like a stalactite formation or something.
Exactly. And so I put those kind of in a very like oval kind of shape. It's very long and rounded shape, and I hung it from the ceiling, and I hung it about at waist height, and people wouldn't pass it at its points.
Yeah.
So people didn't really want to go around it, but I made the exhibition kind of an L shape so that you had to go around it. So some people didn't want to pass against the wall and be pinned by it. Other people would walk around and feel a little bit trapped in the back of the gallery and want to come out. So it was weird to, they wanted to walk around it, but they didn't want to get too close.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at this very vulnerable waist-like height, and I wanted people to feel kind of what it was like to be tracked or hunted.
Yeah.
And most of the time, like, we don't experience that. And then there was also, like, I put a few photographs in the back that I took of these black photographs I print on black paper.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mostly cyanotype on black paper. And so there were a few of those images in the back. And it was my face reacting to something.
Okay.
And you could barely see them. They were kind of subtle, but you would get up close and you could see a person's face reacting to something. And in the glass and the reflection, you could see the object behind you.
Okay. So they got the full experience by looking at that one image.
Exactly. So there was, because I was definitely interested like in our role at this point in time in nature. And like, are we still hunted? And I would say yes, but mostly by microbes.
Yeah.
So
And if you want to go really extreme, I suppose you could start stalking people in the city and just...
Right, yeah.
Track them down and, like, jump on them and be like, ha, gotcha.
Exactly, yeah. I was also living in Baltimore at the time, which, like, dramatically influenced my work, because I felt hunted in Baltimore. It wasn't a very safe place to live. So there was a lot of times where you can't go out past 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
I feel much safer in Brooklyn. So it was kind of strange to be in an environment, like, nothing happened in the neighborhood I grew up in Texas, absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Baltimore, it was just, like, at any moment, somebody, like, jump out from a corner and, like, grab my purse, you know?
Yeah.
So it was definitely got me thinking a little bit about, I felt like I lived in a forest or a jungle or something,
yeah.
You know?
So, have you explored that same idea with any other works besides the large, whatever you called it?
That was probably that kind of piece. After that, I kind of tried a couple more shell forms, and it just didn't have the same feel as it once did.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went through kind of studying materials, just different materials that I could cast with. And so there was about a year of that where I'm just, like, doing material transformation. Then I started thinking about more of the bigger picture, because when I was in my undergrad, I was thinking on the individual level of, you know, predator-prey, individual, like, one predator, one prey. Then I started thinking about, when I was in grad school, as far as, like, the whole population. Like, what is the whole population subject to between multiple species? And I started thinking about co-extinction. And I started looking at maps of geological time where everything kind of bottlenecked and only a few species survived and then expanded back out again. So I started thinking about how we're dependent on a lot of species within nature and they're dependent on us. For example, like pigeons, rats, and cockroaches actually wouldn't survive without us.
Yeah.
So I started thinking about, you know, if, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, well, you know, if one species becomes extinct, it's not that big of a problem, but it is, because we're usually quite dependent on it, and so are maybe like 10 other species around that. So it spreads out from there. So then I started doing a little bit of study of different animals who kind of live together, and then I made my thesis show was about co-extinction. It was about, you know, if this array of species die out, like, we'll be affected by it. And what are the implications of that? And so I did most, and my statement for the show was just like fact-based. So I wrote a little bit about the work, but it was mostly about, like, here's kind of just the concept of the work. So then I started thinking on, like, a larger scale as far as, like, an environment. And then that's where I took off to different possible environments. A little bit about, you know, what... Like, they found calcium carbonate on Mars, for example. So then I started thinking about, okay, well, different environments. And why, like, what happened there? You know, so I'm kind of curious. So there's this kind of juxtaposition between, like, you know, Earth now, Earth then. So, yeah, it's one of the things I've been thinking about a lot lately.
Yeah, a teacher of mine in high school actually did research on these single-celled organisms called, like, water bears, or tardigrades, I think. And he found that they could be dormant if they're not in water for, like, hundreds of years, and then you reanimate them with some water and they swim around and eat something. Have you ever heard of those? Or?
Yeah, extremophile bacteria microbes. Yeah, they're amazing.
And he thinks that they could have come from another planet, possibly on an asteroid, because they could survive on that.
Well, the panspermia theory, you know, the idea of, well, there's very few scientists, though. There's only very few that believe
the real
that
fringe guys.
Yeah, the real fringe guys believe that some large meteorite hit Mars and kind of blew out part of the planet, and that these extremophile bacteria kind of went dormant on these little rocks floating around the solar system, and a few of them entered our atmosphere, and it can handle, you know, sub-zero temperatures, fire, high temperatures, like, there's stuff that lives around volcano vents in the ocean. So they're thinking that one of these landed here and maybe spawned life here.
So they proved that we really are aliens.
Yeah, which would kind of make sense of our destructiveness, but, like, there's also, you know, in 1993 they found, in Allen Hills, they found that meteorite, and the little worm-like bacteria, and sort of, they couldn't conclude anything from it, because one of the scientists said that it doesn't look like anything I've seen before. It's like, really? You think? So that one they thought, you know, possibly could have come from Mars. But even if, like, it was a little green puddle for 2 weeks, that's enough for me. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's fascinating, you know, something like that. But the calcium carbonate is really, the key part of the discovery in the soil
mm-hmm.
on Mars, because that's something that can only be formed with water.
Okay.
So it has to bind, carbon, calcium have to bind with water through a life process in order to produce calcium carbonate.
Okay.
So bone shells, teeth, that sort of thing.
Decent possibility that there was at one time some water in some life.
Maybe some crustaceans, like, even if it was just that. I mean, and the other thing is, you know, I'm kind of curious, like, at what point was that? Like, is it possible that life existed on both of our planets, you know, at the same time? Like,
mm-hmm.
that would have been really cool, too, so...
Mm-hmm. So, if you want to get to talking
sure.
more about some of your specific works and how you're exploring some of these ideas and what you produce, where would you like to start with those pieces? Or
yeah, we can
we're
start
looking
with
at these.
Right
here.
Yeah, so these are these rectangular aluminum pans, and they sort of at one point they were for displaying of my soap skeletons. So I did these soap castings,
okay.
and I made these hybrid skeletons where I take different animal bones, cast the bones into soap, and then reconstruct them into a hybrid species. And these were called anthropoids, which is kind of a play on words with, like, anthropoids, like anthropomorphic, or and something that, you know, having a human sort of essence to it, a human interference with it. And I kind of wanted to show that how, like, we're actually changing species by altering genetics and altering what they produce and how they live with us. We're kind
mm-hmm.
of altering species a little bit. So that was something that I wanted to put in with the co-extinction theme of my thesis. So what I did was I laid these bones out on these aluminum pans, and it's a glycerin-based soap, and it oxidized the aluminum
okay.
and left this print of the remains. And then after I did this series, I kind of got into more of the fossil end of things,
mm-hmm.
the whole skeleton. So these are just kind of like a remnants of what once existed.
Mm-hmm.
And so this kind of piece was a little unintentional because I didn't expect the soap to oxidize it so quickly.
Yeah.
And when
so
I
it was just for display, and then you're like, hey, I accidentally made
it. Yeah.
Something.
It was, and it was kind of great. And I definitely love when that happens. And I definitely think that, you know, when an artist stumbles upon something like that, they should keep it, you know, and they should try to make it work, because it is a part of the work, and it is a part of the series of this work, and it definitely helped as a stepping stone to get me to the next process after grad school, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you want to look, there's a couple, you know, there's this piece back here, too.
Mm-hmm.
So the most recent thing I've done, I'm still working with the soap, but I also do a little bit of silicone casting, too. So this one is a deer hoof. I just started trying to cast taxidermy, and I've never really been into taxidermy, honestly. Like,
yeah.
it creeps me out. I either like animals alive and well, or their skeletal form. Like, anything
like
between
in
is... Yeah, I like in the middle. It's a little too questionable and creepy, but I do like the way it comes out in the soap, and actually all the hairs came out.
Yeah,
I can
see
expect.
That. You can, like, actually see the fuzz of the deer's
yeah.
fur around the hoof.
And so another casting of that is actually in a show down the street right now
okay.
At Pratt's. Yeah, so that went, and it ended up coming into, like, an actual piece. So I kind of want to play around with that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then up here, this series I curated at Northlight Gallery, and I did a show called Exogenesis, and it was about possible life on other planets, and there's a
mm-hmm.
few artists that I had gone to grad school with. And the pieces up here on the top, it's a resin skin that I made to look like bacterial growth,
okay.
and it's pressed in acrylic.
Okay.
So I wanted it to kind of make it look like microscope slides.
Is it, like, completely encased in the acrylic there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
It's kind of mounted
pressed.
On a board, so it looks like a scientific
display. Yeah, exactly. And then these here are actually eroded sand dollars that I stacked to kind of make them look like meteorites a little bit. But this
okay.
was more of the calcium carbonate end of the piece. So my work in the show was very literal,
mm-hmm.
where some of the other artists kind of went off. I told them, no green men, no spaceships. It's like, well, you can go anywhere else you want.
Okay.
So, but yeah, that was a case.
Were those all eroded sand dollars that you found? Or
yeah, I found on the beach, yeah.
How long does it take to find? There's like a few dozen up
there. It was actually kind of strange. I was in Pensacola with my parents, and it was in the winter, it was in January, and nobody was there,
yeah.
which means the beaches weren't overpicked. So we were able to, like, kind of collect things. So I was just shoving shells in my parents' pockets. I'm like, here, take these back to the hotel. So it was really fun.
Mm-hmm.
So that piece I really like because it doesn't, I mean, there's also, you know, so many different angles to the objects that you find. You know, there's like the classic cartoon form of the sand dollar, but then there's also so much going on inside the sand dollar. People are fascinated with the outside, but there's like a whole world on the inside of the sand dollar.
What is the structure of it? It looks kind of porous.
Yeah, it's like a porous, spongy kind of structure on the inside. So it actually looks like the inside of our bones, kind of.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's kind of weird to think about.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And so you mentioned that several of your pieces use soap. What was the idea with using soap to cast things? Because it's not bone-like, obviously.
Right.
It's very different.
The soap, well, at first it was the attraction of the soap. I really liked clear soap. It looked kind of icy, a little frosty, a little glassy. And so it was just kind of like a very pure form or material to cast in. And then I started working with the disappearance of species with like the co-extinction series. And I started thinking about like what's going to disappear in front of your eyes. And it's like this clear soap kind of disappears. And it's like it leaves this residual effect. And it looks like something is kind of leaving you. It's fleeting as you're watching it. And that's sort of how I see a lot of nature is kind of looking like that to me too, where just like environments are fleeting and species are fleeting. So, you know, I wanted to pick a material that would communicate that, but also soap is just like a wonderful material to work with, and your studio's cleaner when you're done. So, and I think it communicated the concept very clearly, and it also it holds the light really well, especially when it's on aluminum. So as an exhibition piece, it's like amazing to light, and it's also very attractive to the eye, so it definitely brings people in close, and I want people to come in and observe. So
as far as a material, have you ever considered exploring that by like actually you can make soap dissolve pretty easily, just like really dripping water on it, having a process based piece where it kind of melts in front of them?
Yeah, I thought about that, and I tried a series of pieces where I was submerging objects in liquids. So I did bone in milk, I did soap in milk, I did soap in water. And what would happen to the soap is it would turn white. It would just take in a little water and turn white and then bend. And I was like, no.
It's not what I expected.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, maybe I could do like a running bath. But the problem is the skeleton shape would get lost. So I was trying to figure out like a way to get like a water cycle passing through that wouldn't obstruct the shape of the skeleton. And then I started casting ice a little bit, and the ice bones came out really nice. Like the detail is kind of amazing. But they only exist for about 30 seconds. So I'd have to get like a big freezer to do it. And then maybe slowly lower the temperature like through the exhibition. But another piece I've been wanting to do is like a piece for an opening. You know, like I would cast a skeleton in ice, and then, you know, it would melt by the end of the opening. So that's something I would like to do at some point. Because I really like the idea of a piece being just for a moment.
Do you make your own soap, like from scratch?
No, I buy it in like these giant buckets of like glycerin-based soap, and it's the kind of soap that you, if you were going to be a soap maker, you would buy this, and then you would add oils or perfume, and
so
then shape it. And
kind of the raw soap base that you're getting.
Exactly. I tried making my own soap. It was a massacre.
It's complicated. I watched a show about it. It's a real homesteading skill.
It really is, yeah. It definitely is. And I tried to make some of my own stuff, too. Like, I tried to make my own beer, and you know, which went better than the soap.
Yeah, so. Beer, you just call it mellow for a while and ferment.
Yeah, it was a lot easier.
As long as you put it together right in the first place, I suppose.
But. I mean, making soap is like making a cream sauce when you're cooking. It's the same problem. You're trying to get the sort of the fats to like blend in with everything else, and it was really, you know, it was hard to get them to go together. It kept separating. So.
And so, what are some of the pieces that you have that aren't sitting right here, like some of your other soap pieces? Or
yeah, I have, I started doing a series of like little birds, too, that I would do in soap. And if you want, I can actually show you, I have my website queued up.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Should I grab that? So this is some of the series I was doing, you know, just kind of playing around the studio. This is kind of how the pieces started out. I was playing with like different bones and trying to pair them together.
Okay.
So I did this whole, it was like this giant aluminum sheet that I laid down on the table, and I put about 5 different skeletons on them, and just seeing how they all kind of go together. So this is kind of what they look like here in this format. And then this was the bones and milk, which actually ended up being a great photo series, not so much a sculpture series.
Yeah.
In life, it looks kind of gross. And it doesn't stay nice very long. You know, it doesn't stay that pure white.
Starts souring.
Yeah, it eventually turns to cheese. So it was like, oh, okay, this isn't a great exhibition piece. So then I started like trying to find different ways to display my work, like different science, you know, displays. So
you got the glass jars with different objects.
Yeah, I was like, let me try the test tube glass jar thing just to see, you know, kind of. And then once I started, you know, really getting into science displays, I was like, okay, how can I make a place for observation? And I started making these. These are the pans that you see here on the wall.
Okay.
This is their original format.
Okay, it's just suspended from the ceiling. It's got the skeleton lying on it.
And one of the problems with sculpture is how to get it off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's always been a problem because some people put the sculpture on the ground, on the wall, on a pedestal, and it's always touching the ground or a structure in the gallery. And I wanted it to not touch anything. I wanted it to just be and float, you know.
Yeah.
And it was kind of one of those things where I was like, I wish I could make a sculpture float. And like, I kind of found a way to do it, which is just suspending it. And every exhibition I do, I usually have a piece suspending it. That's like my final conclusion on how to display it.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything else, it grounds the work too much.
Yeah.
And I just wanted it to be only about the work. And I just wanted people to be able to get close. So I hung it about 4 feet off the ground, maybe 3 or 4 feet. And so people, it would just come right up, almost just below their chest, so they could just look over it. And yeah, so that ended up being that piece. So these are some of the birds I started making after grad school. So
okay.
I started trying to cast really thin bones.
Yeah, very, very thin.
Yeah, really, really skinny bones. You know, tiny little rib bones and tails and really frail, you know.
What I find unusual about skeletons is, like, it's actually pretty hard to identify the animal without all the flesh when it gets down to the bones. Like, you see a cat skeleton, it doesn't really look like a cat at all.
Not at all, yeah. Or, like, a rodent skull. I mean, those are terrifying, you know. The animal's quite cute, so.
Uh-huh.
And this was one of the ones I had in my solo show on the Lower East Side. So this was the biggest skeleton I made. This is about, you know, a human size.
Okay.
And it's just a combination of deer bones, human bones, and pig bones. So I made this giant thing. So, and then I also did, I tried, you know, the same castings but in a different material. And this is bismuth and tin. And it looks like kind of like aluminum. A little bit, and I did this series of jewelry because I was starting to think about, you know, what are some of the ways bones are sort of introduced to us, and a lot of times it's based on food or ornamentation. So this was kind of a series I did, and I started out casting bones in metal. That's how I started, with like foundry process casting. And I liked it in metal, and I liked the way it looked, but it was very heavy. It didn't communicate as a natural artifact. And then it goes into, like, kind of a gimmicky realm if you, you know, if you take it too far.
Yeah.
So.
Before you know it, you're just making nature-based jewelry. And
yeah, and I
didn't. Selling it at a store in Santa Fe.
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, oh, I don't want to go there with it. So I did a little bit for this show, and it was odd enough that the one thing that sold was the broccoli necklace.
Okay.
So that's, like, been the one that people seem to be, like, you know, a little more attracted to. So that's kind of, you know. And then I started doing these fossil plates, too.
Okay.
I think,
like,
you know,
an impression of the skeleton in metal.
Exactly. Yeah.
Is that a smaller one or a large one?
Yeah, it's very tiny. It's about this big.
Okay.
Like
a pendant necklace size.
Yeah,
okay.
It's kind of, it's almost like a breastplate. It's kind of big.
Yeah.
So I did those. But it was fun to kind of experiment a little bit with that. So that was, like, one of the series I did.
With your interest in this kind of scientific background, everything, have you ever found it tempting to just do it as a science and not as an artist anymore.
Yes. When I was 7, I wanted to be a paleontologist. Yeah. And my mother told me I'd make no money, so I became an artist.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's kind of funny that I was tempted to go into the sciences, but I felt that the way the education process is in public school, they don't teach you appreciation of science or appreciation of math. They throw you right into the meat of it. And if you're not going to be a chemist, you don't really need the periodic table of the elements. Like, that's the first thing they teach you in class, which should kind of be towards the end of your education.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't really teach science appreciation. So I would take the science classes and they just bog you down with formulas and facts.
Yeah.
And it wasn't interesting facts. It was just things you had to memorize and put back on paper. And so I kind of pulled away from that, and I found that I could do anything in art. Like, I could bring science into art, and as much science as I wanted, and the parts of science I really enjoyed. But now, as I'm, like, getting a little older, now I kind of appreciate all those little facts and formulas that I learned.
Yeah.
And I'm pulling more into, like, a science realm. So, but I still want to bridge the two, because I think it's very important to bridge art and science together. They have a similar process. They're heading in similar directions. They're becoming more conceptual, more technology-based.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like scientists and artists have a lot of the same problems as far as, like, funding and, like, getting appreciation for their work.
Yeah.
You know? And also I think, you know, as for me, I think science is really important just as something we need to absorb as a culture. And for my contribution, like, I'm trying to put science into art so that it'll eventually become appreciated by, like, the masses.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really feel like that's a better way to be progressive, is to, you know, be more well-rounded.
Yeah.
So, but that's kind of, yeah. But I think, you know, as far as my... you know, where my art is going, I'm definitely trying to keep, like, a constant stream of facts coming in and research coming in. And I just did a class with GenSpace, which is a do-it-yourself biotechnology lab.
Okay.
And it's very affordable. You can go and take a few classes, and they actually teach you how to sequence your own DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll let you propose a project and let you do it in the lab. So it's just like... an art studio, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, they do a little demo, you go in, you start making your work.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that to be very accessible for people who don't have a science background or who are interested in just getting right into the meat of the laboratory.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Yeah. So this is some of the other castings I did. This one here, which looks like something that you'd see in you know, a natural history museum.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the direction things were going in, then I stopped it because I didn't want to go to the museum route, you know, just yet. I didn't want to go there, even though it would be fun to do, you know, museum display.
Mm-hmm.
But this was the piece. This one I consider, like, this was definitely the highlight of my master's, was being able to cast, you know, precision in the foundry process.
Mm-hmm.
And so these were a couple pieces I did. And you can see how, like, in metal, like, this is iron. It's, like, it's very heavy. I mean, it looks a little more, like, decorative almost, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of wanted to pull away from that, pull away from the heaviness of it. So these were a couple pieces I had done. So it's, you know, and the other thing I was thinking, you know, like, with this kind of like, with my experience with bone casting, like, another science route I could go down would be to, like, do bone casting for exhibitions.
Mm-hmm.
Bone casting for paleontologists and archaeologists, you know, and be able to replicate what they find, because usually they just slather plaster on top of the fossils.
Mm-hmm.
And they chip away at it later so they can ship it. But there are other ways to do it. Like, you can do, like, a silicone, for example, and
yeah.
then not only will you have a mold of the fossil, but it'll be completely protected, you know. So it's like that I would like to introduce into the field, or possibly get a little experience at doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely, like, one of my dream jobs would be to do that.
And so, in the future, like, how, or the near future, how do you see your work kind of developing, and what kind of presentation modes are you thinking of moving into? Or,
well, I'm kind of getting into bio art a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So, what I want to do is grow my own art in
yeah.
a way. So, there's this kombucha-based cellulose paper that you can grow,
okay.
and the bacteria, the microbes, actually produce this, like, gel, like, I don't know, it's like this weird gel, like, skin on top of, like, a bath.
So it's like a tub of water that you grow the paper on, and you just pull it off.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it just grows. It takes about 2 weeks, and then you can lay it out on a piece of wood, and it'll dry out. And then you can cut it, shape it. You can wrap it around an object, and it'll dry to the shape of that object.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of perfect for casting. So
yeah, that sounds really interesting. I've never heard of this.
Yeah, so it's this. If you're curious, Suzanne Lee is a fashion designer, and she makes clothes from this stuff.
Okay.
And it's sustainable, and it's very cheap to make.
Mm-hmm.
You just need green tea, sugar, and the organism, and it's a combination of bacteria and yeast together. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I drink it sometimes. I know.
Yeah, kombucha is really
kind
good.
Of what's in it. Yeah.
So it's basically you're making your own. Yeah, exactly. You make your own kombucha, and then you get a microbe with it. So I was thinking about doing something based on that. So that's actually the next process I'm getting into.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I would like to do is if I could somehow grow a sculpture, put it on some sort of life support reactive to water, because I know the cellulose absorbs water and releases water.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a way that I can make it reactive to maybe humidity or water in the gallery space,
mm-hmm.
like, that would be ideal. So I'm working with Observatory in Gowanus, and they're actually doing a bio art show, so I'm going to be working with their curators to try and make a piece, and that's going to be in March.
Cool.
So yeah, so I'll definitely keep you posted on that show.
Yeah.
When you know what happens. So basically I'll be doing science experiments in my house.
Nice.
So
get out the test tubes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I just found the picture of the piece I was going to show you. Yeah. So you can see when this is my thesis piece in undergrad. So these are how the shell forms kind of look.
That's big.
Yeah, it's pretty big. It was a really fun piece to make. But see how it just kind of floats above the ground a little
mm-hmm.
bit. So yeah, a lot of people saw different things. They saw a whale, a shark, a squid, a spiral shell.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that kind of made me want to take on more of like a spiral or a shell form was that I learned that spiral shells are actually predatory.
Really?
Yeah, which I didn't know.
So is a snail predatory?
It might be, actually. Yeah. It might be. That's a good question. But I think, you know, a lot of these things that we see are very gentle or pretty, or we find like the remains of them all over the place. Like,
mm-hmm.
they're actually like kind of an aggressive species.
Yeah.
But we wouldn't know because we're not really watching them. Yeah, so that was... but yeah, you can see how like... It's like this height I find is a really, like, hanging something 3 or 4 feet above the ground.
Mm.
It's a really good height for not only for making kind of a statement or a presence for something like this, where you want something kind of predatory, make the viewer maybe feel a little vulnerable or a little take a step back a little bit, like for this piece.
Mm-hmm.
But then I kind of switched over and I was like, I really want them to get close to my work. I don't want them to be scared of it.
Yeah.
I want them to come in and observe. But I kept the same height, and it's funny, like, that same height works both ways.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I figure if you place an object that's going towards the viewer's gut or crotch, they probably feel
yeah, right, it's a torso realm, yeah. Or something, like, in the neck area, too, you know,
yeah.
And it's funny that we still have that kind of instinct to be like, oh...
looking like photos of skeletons.
Exactly, yeah. It's kind of, it's almost like an opaque x-ray.
Yeah.
So some of these, this was actually a dog skeleton that I bought online. I didn't find.
They sell those online?
They do, yeah, for like science or classroom displays.
Okay.
They sell like, yeah, different domestic species to study from. It's mostly like cats and dogs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And which I'm...
I was thinking like eBay for something.
Oh yeah.
Big
Craigslist, yeah.
Bucks.
So actually I got this, I started taking pictures of it. I wanted to cast from it.
Mm-hmm.
But I just found, like, in photo form, once again, like, some pieces I really feel like should exist in photo form, and then others should exist in life.
Mm-hmm.
So this, you know, was... These pieces definitely...
Would this be stuff that you would show alongside the physical objects, too?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I show them together. But they're just kind of, you know, an imprint of something that used to be there that isn't quite there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to see, hold on, what did I do? If you want to see them together. Okay, so in the space where I had those hanging pins, I also had the photos here.
Okay, so they're off to the side on the grid format.
Yeah. So those were kind of... Yeah, you can kind of see it here, too.
Mm-hmm.
And this was all at the opening.
That's very modernist with all the rectangular forms
yeah.
and the grids. And having the... skeleton forms on the aluminum pans kind of looks like an autopsy table almost, especially at that height where it's like kind of hanging from the ceiling for
exactly
that
yeah.
to look at.
That was one of the things I was, you know, I was thinking about, and when I was researching for ways to display, I was looking at a lot of medical equipment
yeah.
because it definitely has like the. I wanted something very clean and minimal, but to reference a laboratory or scientific study, but I didn't want it to go too clinical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just wanted to have, like, a hint of it, but not too... Because I had tried something once before where I tried to set up an observation table and would put tools on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it went into a direction I didn't really... Like, it lost the sophistication a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it lost the quality a little bit. And it just looked like a work surface. So
yeah.
I tried to avoid that a little bit. So this was kind of, you know, you walk in and... And then I had this piece over here. And then I just had a few bird skulls just as like an
yeah.
entrance piece just to bring people in a little bit.
Mm, just to wet their palate.
Yeah.
For
exactly. Let's see here. Back to exhibitions. So this is some of like the science-based work I've been doing now. So there are a few things where I'm just, you know, playing with different materials or, you know, this is the piece here that I was showing you that was in the astrobiology show
mm-hmm.
with the bacteria plates. And then there was this is where I was like kind of washing the skeleton that had got, it was sitting in my studio and it was in the summer and it was starting to sweat
yeah.
because the soap was very reactive to the environment and I was starting to beat up in sweat and it was just like, it was a mess. So I washed them, I cleaned them and I laid them out and I just started documenting them like as I was cleaning them.
Mm-hmm.
You can see how they're kind of more white here because they're absorbing, they're like taking on water,
okay.
they're absorbing it. This is the deer hoof that you see behind us here. And then I did, I was working with bird dinosaurs a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And I
raptor.
Yeah, like a raptor, like a the micro raptor they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're starting to find that within fossils of dinosaurs that there's a feather pattern.
Yeah, I think I saw that specifically with the raptor where they think
yeah.
it may have had feathers covering parts of it.
And it's really cool because certain proteins and certain pigments will show up. So black and red pigments stay in a fossil.
Okay.
Whereas white, like white or a blue or a yellow might not show up in the fossil.
Okay.
So when there's nothing, they know it was white.
Mm-hmm.
And when there's a trace of something that they can't make it out, it's probably like a blue or a yellow. But definitely brown, black, and red
mm-hmm.
show up. And you can kind of see like a halo around the skeleton and they're finding that that's what that was. That
yeah.
it's a possibility that dinosaurs were actually covered in feathers.
So
also,
Jurassic Park is just totally...
Totally off.
Yeah. They messed that
yeah.
one up.
Entirely. And, you know, they weren't these you know, green or gray or brown like we thought.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually came from the World War II era because those were the only pigments that they were making in the country.
Okay.
Because that's why they were painting tanks and
yeah.
or, you know, all of that. They were using those three pigments, so that was the most readily available. So an artist picked
that's
those.
That's inadvertently informed, like, how we
yeah.
think of... what dinosaurs were like.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So like blue and red and yellow are hard to get a hold of. So
mm-hmm.
in these books, in the illustration books, they're just like, okay, we'll go green and brown.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuck, and they were trying to think of what would match the natural environment. So
mm-hmm.
a friend of mine, Emmy Brady, we collaborated. She mostly works with birds, and she's a printmaker. But we came together to make this bird dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked out a skeleton online, and then I cut it out in silicone. And I made a stencil, and we tagged a building in Crown Heights. So it was a really fun project to do. She actually just moved to Colorado, so she wanted to leave her mark in the neighborhood she lived in for 5 years.
Yeah.
So this is another one. We kind of blended in with some other work
yeah.
that was on the outside of the building. So this was the actual stencil here.
Okay.
So, and that's also behind you, if you see above the desk. That was a whale we did at Observatory Gowanus. There was a whale that actually got stuck in the canal 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a piece about that. And so that's the positive and the negative form of that. This is the bismuth and tin alloy. You can actually melt on a pan, melts at the same temperature as wax.
Yeah.
So that one, you can actually melt on your stove, melts at 200 degrees, and then I was casting with that. So this is just some, like, the random things I've been messing with, and some of the odd jobs I've been doing. Like, I'm a welder now, so I do tape welding.
Cool.
That's been my, welding's been my, sort of my profession for a few years, so it's kind of what I've been into, and I was teaching a little bit at Pratt. When I was in grad school, so it's mostly. But there was like one job I did where I was fiberglassing, so there's a little bit of that. This is some jewelry making. I did my bathtub, trying to do some casting. So I've been trying to do everything I can from my household, just because most studios don't have all the equipment I need, like a microwave and a stove and like a fridge. Because sometimes if I'm rushed, I'll put the molds in the fridge to cool them off. And so it's like I feel like working in the home has been a lot easier for me. And I could also multitask too, so these are the bacteria plates kind of close up here. You can kind of see them a little better. And this way I was trying to grow crystals, so just the things you play with when you were a kid. And this is the silicone skin I've been pouring and cutting from. And then I usually, like, in the exhibition, we pass light through these.
Okay.
So we would definitely...
have a light projection of the skeleton form.
Exactly. Yeah, so that's what it looked like in the exhibition space. So this is just, just, like, a few things I've been trying out. Another side project I did, which I won't really... I wouldn't put it in a show, but it's just kind of something I was playing with, is this over here. This is a window farm. So it's a drip system window farm.
Okay.
And all the bottles have holes in them, so it just feeds the next plant down. So it's definitely something that I want to do eventually. But just playing with, technology and nature together. But it does kind of inform, like, the life support system that I want to do with the bio art. So I'm kind of thinking a little about that. There's one more thing I wanted to show you. The exogenesis piece. So this is the show that I curated, at North Lake Gallery. So this was my work. This is Megan Suttles. I went to Pratt with her, and she does accumulation art. She'll take one thing and just repeat it over and over again. And then this is Lee Puckett. He made this giant asteroid, which I love this piece. This was like such a fun piece. And then I'll also show you, that was the opening. This is Jessica Johnson's work. She's a geneticist, actually. She did her undergrad in mostly like biology and genetics, DNA. And then she went into her MFA program, New Forms. So this is another person who's trying to bridge art and science together. So I've been trying to reach out and find other artists that are trying to do the same thing. And it's surprisingly, there are a lot of artists out there that are doing that. But it's different areas of science. So they'll pick like a very specific part of science and pull it into their work, whether they're a sculptor or a painter or a drawer. So this was Megan's. But yeah, this was actually this show, we got a lot of attention for the show. A lot of people were interested in it. It was just fun. It was just, in general, it was like a fun show to do.
Yeah.
And it was mostly, people that I knew, so we were able to just, like, kind of do what we wanted.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it came together. And then I also, I didn't want to get too science fair, but I put a bunch of, like, literature here. So I had images and a few articles, like some NASA articles about findings on Mars and stuff. So, because I wanted to keep, like, the fact base in there somewhere.
Yeah.
So. And then just one more picture. This is me trying to fit it in the back of my car.
People see you driving around with an asteroid.
Yeah. It's like she stole it off of the airbase or something. Yeah. So that's just kind of what I've been up to lately.
Well, so I think I got a pretty good understanding of your work. Anything else you want to follow up with an explanation or anything you want to touch back on? Or?
I think that's probably, that's probably about it. There was just, a few things there. I think, as far as, like, where I'm going next, it seems like it's been, like, a constant thread, It's like my work is constantly morphing, and you can kind of see what I did right before and right after for each piece. And I think, like, the bio art I think it's a pretty healthy direction to go in at this point.
Yeah.
Because I really don't want to, like, continue doing the work I did in grad school. I kind of want to branch out and try something new. And I usually have multiple projects going on at one time. So I think, you know, that's kind of the direction to go in at this point. And I definitely want to continue with the science classes because I feel like that's definitely informing my work now.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like, just, like, as a, you know, in the future, like, I definitely want to keep reading and keep listening to podcasts and just keep bringing information in, which I think is healthy for all artists to do, you know,
mm-hmm.
keep the research flowing. But yeah, so I'm kind of on to, it's almost like I came from a natural sort of observation base, and I kind of circled around right back to it. So I'm getting closer and closer back to the natural organism
yeah.
and its life forms. So.
Almost full circle.
Almost full circle,
yeah.
yeah. So we'll see where it goes
cool.
from there.
Well, it was
yeah.
good talking with you.
It was nice talking to you, too.
Yeah. See you around.
Thanks.
And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Nikki Romanello. You can find her work online at nikkiromanello.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, mattkuhlman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee I can continue providing interviews with artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit bigredandshiny.com for future episodes along with other high-quality arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.